of RIP, Revelation Investigation Prosecution, that led from Watergate to Whitewater. Starr proved an indefatigable investigator. He spent years and tens of millions of taxpayer dollars following every lead, right down to a blue dress stained with presidential semen. In 1996, a former White House aide named Linda Tripp met Lewinsky at the Pentagon, where they both worked. Tripp began recording her conversations with Lewinsky about Clinton in 1997. She then gave those recordings to Jones's lawyers. Tripp also told Lewinsky to never wash that blue dress. By this time, Clinton had helped Lewinsky get a job in New York. On learning about the tapes, Starr began an investigation into a possible obstruction of justice. The Lewinsky story broke not in a newspaper of record like the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, but on the internet, when Matt Drudge at the Drudge Report revealed the allegations at 11:27 p.m. on Saturday night, January 17, 1998. Clinton asked his in-house pollster, Dick Morris, to conduct an instant poll to decide what to do. Morris told the president that Americans would not forgive him an affair. The Washington Post printed the story on January 21st. That afternoon, Clinton agreed to an interview with PBS's Jim Lehrer. Later that night, in a meeting in the White House solarium, Deputy Chief of Staff Harold Ickes told the president that the interview had been a disaster. "You look like a fucking dog that's been running all night and someone just kicked the shit out of you. I've never seen such a performance in my life. Nobody believed you." 5 days later, in the presence of his wife, Clinton delivered an address from the Roosevelt Room and said, "I did not have sexual relations with that woman." The next morning on the Today Show, Hillary Clinton attributed the allegations to a vast right-wing conspiracy. To cover the Lewinsky story, Ailes launched a new 6 o'clock p.m. newscast special report hosted by Britt Hume and moved commentator Bill O'Reilly's The O'Reilly Factor from 6 o'clock to 8 o'clock p.m. By the time the story had played out, Fox News had beaten MSNBC in the ratings war and was on its way to beating CNN. Partisan coverage produced partisan opinion. By the time the House voted on impeachment, 58% of independents and 84% of Democrats would oppose it, while some 2 out of 3 Republicans would support it. But Fox News had no monopoly on in-depth coverage of the Lewinsky affair. Broadcast and television news, magazines and newspapers all covered each new detail of the president's encounters with his intern, which included inserting a cigar into her vagina, and then, as most Americans believed, lying about it on national television and before a grand jury. "The country is awash in the muck of the White House nastiness," columnist A.M. Rosenthal wrote in the Times, "and dirty with the cynicism that flows from it." In September 1998, Starr submitted to the House his 445-page report, along with some 2,600 pages of documentary evidence. The details, both of the affair and of Clinton's efforts to cover it up, were at once ridiculous, embarrassing, and terrible. Columnist Andrew Sullivan wrote, "Clinton is a cancer on the culture, a cancer of cynicism, narcissism, and deceit." But the cause of the cancer lay elsewhere. The United States had endured eras of heightened partisanship before, in the 1790s, say, or the 1850s. But beginning in the 1990s, the nation started a long fall into an epistemological abyss. The conservative media establishment, founded on the idea that the mass media establishment was biased, had built into its foundation a rejection of the idea that truth could come from weighing different points of view, which, after all, is the whole point of partisan disputation. Instead, the conservative media establishment engineered a failsafe against dissent. As one historian explained, when an outlet like the New York Times criticized a liberal policy, conservative media activists presented it not as evidence of the paper's even-handedness, but as evidence of the policy's failure. Even the liberal New York Times had to admit. Thus, evidence that seemed to undermine the charge of liberal bias could be reinterpreted to support it. The nation had lost its way in the politics of mutually assured epistemological destruction. There was no truth, only innuendo, rumor, and bias. There was no reasonable explanation. There was only conspiracy. The White House hired private detectives to find dirt about Starr and about other investigators. Voters found the investigation as reprehensible as Clinton, or more so. By a margin of 2-1, women thought the press coverage had gone too far. Still, they blamed Republicans for making a spectacle of the presidency. Republicans who'd hoped to gain seats in the 1998 midterms lost them. After the election, House Speaker Gingrich, who was already on his second wife, learned that his own affair with a congressional aide, 23 years his junior, was about to be exposed and resigned, blaming cannibals who had blackmailed him into quitting. The Lewinsky scandal indelibly left something else in the aftermath. It diminished liberalism. Liberals defended Clinton almost at all cost, depicting him as a victim. Steinem and other prominent feminists who had crusaded against Clarence Thomas as a perpetrator of sexual harassment waved aside Clinton's dalliances, often with young women, including women in his employ, at some sizable cost to the cause of feminism. Thomas had at one point suggested that he was being subjected to a high-tech lynching. Writing about the Lewinsky investigation in The New Yorker, Toni Morrison said that, "White skin notwithstanding, this is our first black president. He was so cool, so hip, so long-suffering," and compared the investigation to a lynching. "Serious as adultery is, it is not a national catastrophe," Morrison said. Adultery is not a national catastrophe, but Bill Clinton was no more subjected to a lynching than was Clarence Thomas. On February 12, 1999, the Senate narrowly defeated two charges of impeachment on perjury and obstruction of justice. 4 days later, Paul Weyrich circulated a letter in which he announced the failure of the Christian right. The Christian Coalition fell into debt, and investigated both by the FEC and the IRS, its membership numbers had plummeted by 1997. But that wasn't the kind of failure Weyrich was talking about. Even if the Christian Coalition had fallen apart, conservatives had won elections and appointed judges. But they hadn't been able to stop what Weyrich called the collapse of the culture into an ever-widening sewer. "I no longer believe there is a moral majority," Weyrich wrote. "I do not believe that a majority of Americans actually share our values." "If they did," he said, "Bill Clinton would have been driven out of office months ago." A curtain closed on the culture wars. People on the political right set out to unseat a president, and they almost succeeded, Anthony Lewis wrote in the New York Review of Books. In his folly, Clinton played into their hands, but that does not alter the fact that this country came close to a coup d'etat. The most that many Americans began to expect Congress to accomplish in any given session was possibly to avoid a shutdown and at best to agree on a budget. The government had been reduced to a shambles. Attempting to stage a coup d'etat became an ordinary part of every American presidency. Opponents of each of the next three presidents, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and Donald J. Trump, would call them unconstitutional. Members of the House of Representatives would call for impeachment proceedings. Collectors of political paraphernalia interested in documenting this turn could have compiled, by attending political rallies during any year after 1994, calls for an end to an American presidential administration. "Impeach Clinton," signs came in every color. "Impeach Bush," they came in block letters and cursive. "Impeach Obama," they were staked in front yards. "Impeach Trump," they were duct taped to mailboxes. In the summer of 1999, in a nation consumed by the politics of scandal, celebrity, pettiness, and vengeance, rumors began to spread that Donald Trump, 53, intended to run for president. Born in 1947, Trump was the son of a real estate man from Queens. In 1964, he graduated from military school, where he'd been known as a ladies' man. He considered going to the University of Southern California to study film, but ended up studying first at Fordham University, then business at Wharton, graduating in 1968. He spent most of his time reading the listings of foreclosures on federally financed housing projects, he later said. He joined his father's business and set out to conquer Manhattan. In 1973, the Department of Justice charged Trump and his father with violating the 1968 Fair Housing Act. "We have never discriminated," Trump told the New York Times. "And we never would." During the years when the party swapped women for men and Hillary Rodham left the Republican Party to become a Democrat, Donald Trump did the reverse. In the 1970s, Trump began making donations to the Democratic Party. "The simple fact is that contributing money to politicians is very standard and accepted for a New York City developer," he explained in The Art of the Deal, his best-selling business book published in 1987, the year he first toyed with running for president. At the time, Trump was a larger-than-life media presence, a huckster chronically in and out of bankruptcy court, but a reliable ratings booster on the talk show circuit, where he was usually referred to as a hustler. An avid participant in the world of professional wrestling, Trump's forays into politics were generally greeted as stunts. In 1984, he'd offered to serve as an arms negotiator with the Soviet Union. "It would take an hour and a half to learn everything there is to know about missiles," he told the Washington Post. I think I know most of it anyway. In 1987, Trump had flown to New Hampshire, where he was greeted by Trump for President signs. "I'm not here because I'm running for president," he said. "I'm here because I'm tired of our country being kicked around." He promised to eliminate the budget deficit by making countries like Japan, Saudi Arabia, and Kuwait pay their debts. "There's a way you can ask them and they will give it, if you have the right person asking." In the 1990s, the American economy thrived, at least by some measures. Dot-com stock was booming. By the end of Clinton's second term, unemployment had fallen to 4.1%, and the United States was producing nearly a quarter of the world's output, a share never seen before. Not even by the British Empire at its peak in 1913, when it produced 8% of the world's output. And still, for Americans without a college education, and especially for those without a high school diploma, real wages were stagnant or falling. And yet a worship of the very rich was everywhere, from Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, which aired from 1984 to 1985, to the rising fame of gold-plated New York real estate tycoon Donald Trump. During the Lewinsky scandal, Trump, known as a twice-divorced doll-chasing socialite, gleefully offered his opinions as a famous cad about the affair. The Lewinsky scandal had elevated Trump from pop culture celebrity businessman to political commentator. "Paula Jones is a loser," he said on NBC's Hardball with Chris Matthews. "But the fact is that she may be responsible for bringing down a president indirectly." Clinton's statement was a disaster, Trump said, and he should have taken the Fifth Amendment. He'd have had more respect for Bill Clinton, Trump said, if he'd had sex with a supermodel instead of with Lewinsky. Keen to remain in the spotlight, Trump published a new book, The America We Deserve, that had all the trappings of a campaign manifesto. In a chapter called Should I Run?, Trump pointed to a survey that documented his name recognition. "It was no surprise to me that 97% of the American people know who I was." His supporters launched a website, www.thedonald2000.org. The National Enquirer conducted a poll of 100 people who very much liked Trump. "Readers of the Enquirer," Trump said, "were the real people." He said, "I think the kind of people who support me are the workers, the construction workers, the taxicab driver. Rich people don't like me." The National Enquirer survey allowed Trump to report, "The polls have been unbelievable." Trump knew exactly what he was up to. He said that he'd choose Oprah Winfrey as his running mate, and if the establishment laughed, that was their error. The establishment did laugh. "Mr. Trump is trying to determine whether there is a place in American political life for a rogue," the New York Times reported. But Trump knew that Americans were disillusioned. "I'm considering a run only because I'm convinced that the major parties have lost their way," he explained. "The Republicans, especially those in Congress, are captives of their right wing. The Democrats are captive of their left wing. I don't hear anyone speaking for the working men and women in the center. There's very little contact between the concerns and interests of ordinary people and the agendas of politicians." Trump boasted of his legendary deal-making, but his real attraction to voters, he told the columnist Maureen Dowd, was his personality and his sex appeal. "I think the only difference between me and the other candidates," he said, "is that I'm more honest and my women are more beautiful." His candidacy didn't go much beyond talking points, but he did offer policy proposals. To close the budget deficit, he suggested raising $5.7 trillion with a one-time 14.25% tax on the net worth of people and trusts worth $10 million or more. As for the rest of his economic plan, he said, that would be determined and worked out. In remarks outlining his possible foreign policy, he insulted France, a terrible partner, Germany, they failed militarily, Japan, ripping us big league, and Saudi Arabia, I mean the money they make, and suggested that if elected president, he would double as a U.S. trade representative. "And I guarantee you," he said on Fox News, "the ripoff of the United States would end." Serious political commentators did not even elevate his candidacy to that of a crank. They considered him a buffoon. "The only thing standing between Donald Trump and the presidency," wrote syndicated columnist Mark Shields, "is the good judgment of the American people." By January 2000, www.thedonald2000.org was for sale. "Are these people stiffs or what?" Trump said later that month, watching a GOP primary debate. "They're losers," he said. "Who the hell wants to have a person like this for president?" The Republican who did win the nomination that year was George W. Bush, the governor of Texas and former president's son. With the younger Bush, a Yale graduate and a devout born-again Christian, conservatism got a new face, a new voice, and a new slogan, compassionate conservatism. Big government is not the answer, Bush said at the Republican convention, but the alternative to bureaucracy is not indifference. It is to put conservative values and conservative ideas into the thick of the fight for justice and opportunity. Republican speechwriter David Frum proved skeptical, joking. Love conservatism, but hate arguing about abortion? Try our new compassionate conservatism. Great ideological taste, now with less controversy. Less controversy there would not be. The nation, long divided, turned out to be divided quite evenly. The 2000 election was a nail-biter to end all nail-biters. After it was over, it was by no means clear that the voters had decided the outcome. Instead, the two most dauntingly powerful forces on the battleground of American politics, cable television and the Supreme Court, made the first and eventually the final call. Just before 8 p.m. on election night, the networks announced that Gore had won Florida in a very close vote. Later that night, Fox News countermanded the network's prediction of a Gore victory. Ailes had hired John Ellis, Bush's first cousin, to head Fox News' decision desk. Shortly after 2 a.m., after getting off the phone with Bush's brother, Jeb Bush, the governor of Florida, Ellis cried out, "Jebby says we got it!" Later, before a House committee, Ailes said that there had not been anything inappropriate in his employing Ellis. "Quite the contrary," he said. "I see this as a good journalist talking to his very high-level sources on election night." Fox News then called the election for Bush. 4 minutes later, ABC, CBS, NBC, and CNN followed Fox's lead, naming Bush as the next president. A crestfallen Gore conceded, but then, in yet another twist of a tale as tangled as seaweed, Gore unconceded, telling Bush in a second phone call, "Your little brother is not the ultimate authority on this." A report commissioned by CNN damned the television coverage that night as a news disaster that damaged democracy and journalism and played an important part in creating an ensuing climate of rancor and bitterness. The report missed the point. Television coverage of American politics had helped create that climate, for sure, but years before Bush faced Gore. Gore contested the election. No one disputed that he had won the popular vote by more than 500,000 ballots. That meant that the election turned on a handful of votes needed to capture the electoral vote in Florida. The Florida Supreme Court supported Gore's demand for a manual recount in four counties. There followed 36 days of doubt about the outcome of the election and of the American presidency itself, while a recount was held. Then, astonishingly, on December 12th, the Supreme Court called off the recount, overruling the lower court in a bitterly argued 5-4 decision. In September of 1787, when Americans were first asked to debate the Constitution, many had wondered at the power granted to the Supreme Court. Many wondered again in December of 2000, when the court exercised a power never before known. The five justices that formed the majority had all been named by Reagan or Bush. They rested their decisions on the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, an amendment that had been written and ratified to guarantee the rights of African Americans. "Although we may never know with complete certainty the identity of the winner of this year's presidential election, the identity of the loser is perfectly clear," Justice John Paul Stevens, 80, at a Florida appointee, wrote in a blistering dissent. "It is the nation's confidence in the judge as an impartial guardian of the rule of law." On the final day of his presidency, Clinton made one last deal, in which, in exchange for immunity from prosecution, he admitted to having lied under oath. He and his wife left the White House with more than $190,000 in gifts. An editorial in the Washington Post urged George W. and Laura Bush to count the White House spoons and described the Clintons as having no capacity for embarrassment. Hillary got an $8 million book deal. She and Bill bought two multi-million dollar homes. "Our nation must rise above a house divided," the new president said after Gore conceded. But the nation, its houses newly wired for the internet, was about to come apart, two towers collapsing. Chapter 16. America Disrupted. The first plane crashed into the top floors of the North Tower of the World Trade Center in New York at 8:46 a.m. on September 11, 2001. CNN broke into a commercial to show live footage of the tower, gray smoke billowing out of a black gash in the steel and glass against a nearly cloudless blue sky. On an ordinary day, some 50,000 people worked in the Twin Towers, more than 100 stories high. By 8:45 on that particular Tuesday, nearly 20,000 people had already shown up, wearing hats and pumps, carrying laptops and briefcases. Orders to evacuate or not to evacuate, and whether to go up or go down, conflicted. Most people decided to leave and headed down. As more than 1,000 firefighters, EMTs, and police officers raced to the scene and began rescue efforts, some people trapped on the upper floors, facing insufferable heat and unable to breathe, leapt to their deaths rather than be burned alive. One couple held hands as they fell. From far away, they looked like paper dolls. At 8:52 a.m., Peter Hansen, a passenger on another plane, United Airlines Flight 175, was able to call his father. He asked him to report to authorities that his flight had been hijacked. Hansen, 32, was flying with his wife and their 2.5-year-old daughter. They were going to Disneyland. "I think they've taken over the cockpit," Hansen whispered to his father. The passengers were thinking about trying to gain control of the plane from the terrorists, who'd used knives and mace and said they had a bomb and appeared to have killed the pilots. At 9 o'clock, Hansen called his father again. "I think we're going down," he said. My God," he gasped. 3 minutes later, United 175 crashed into the South Tower of the World Trade Center. Television stations had been covering the fire and the North Tower live. Announcers and reporters watched in horror as the plane hit the South Tower and burst into a fireball. It looked impossible, something out of a 1950s Hollywood disaster film. Props, models, wires, and tin, something that could not happen. King Kong swinging from the Empire State Building, Godzilla climbing the Statue of Liberty. My God," said a host on ABC News. "Oh, Lord." Sirens shrieked, and from the streets there came a wailing. At 9:37 a.m. in Washington, D.C., a third hijacked plane, traveling at 530 miles per hour, crashed into the Pentagon. The hijackers had intended to crash a fourth plane, United Flight 93, into the Capitol, or the White House. This flight, unlike the first three, all of which had departed on time, was running more than half an hour late. It took off at 8:42 a.m. At 9:23, a United flight dispatcher sent out a message, "Beware any cockpit intrusion." At 9:26, the pilot on Flight 93 responded with seeming disbelief, "Confirm latest message, please." 2 minutes later, the hijacker stormed the cockpit. In the moments that followed, 10 of the flight's 33 passengers and the two surviving members of the crew managed to make phone calls. They learned about the attacks on the World Trade Center. They decided to fight back. At 9:47, C.C. Lyles, a flight attendant and mother of four, called her husband and left him a message. "I hope to be able to see your face again, baby," she said, her voice breaking. "I love you." 10 minutes later, the passengers and crew, having taken a vote about what to do, charged the cockpit. The plane began to roll. At 10:03, United Flight 93 plowed into a field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, 20 minutes outside of Washington. Everyone on all four planes died. In New York, emergency workers had entered the towers, evacuating thousands of people, but the burning jet fuel at over 1,000 degrees was weakening the skyscraper's steel girders. At 9:58 a.m., the South Tower collapsed into itself, falling straight to the ground like an elevator shaft, crushing everyone inside. CNN, which had been covering the crash at the Pentagon, cut back to New York, the TV screen showing nothing but cloud upon cloud. For a moment, watching the screen felt like looking out the window of a plane flying through the white. The North Tower fell at 10:28. CNN, there are no words. It seemed altogether possible that there were more attacks to come. "We have some planes," one of the hijackers had said. Poor communication between the Civilian Aviation Authority and the military's Aerospace Command, and the lack of any experience with or protocol for suicide hijacking, meant that the U.S. military had been unable to mount a defense. About 10:15, the vice president authorized the Air Force to shoot down United Flight 93, unaware that it had already met its horrible end. By noon, all flights from U.S. airports were grounded, federal buildings were evacuated, embassies were shuttered, and millions of prayers whispered. The vice president was moved from the White House to an underground bunker, and the president, who had been visiting an elementary school in Florida, was flown to a secure location in Omaha, Nebraska. Nearly 3,000 people had been killed. "America under attack," ran the headline on CNN.com, whose coverage that day included videos, a photo gallery, a timeline, statements from leaders around the world, and emergency resources. NYTimes.com posted a slideshow, maps, a flight tracker, and a list of places to donate blood. The Drudge Report's homepage displayed a pair of police sirens and the question, "Who did this?" And FoxNews.com began an ongoing special report, "Terrorism Hits America." That night, a resolved president delivered a televised address. "A great people has been moved to defend a great nation," George W. Bush said. Even before night had fallen, he committed the United States to waging a war against terrorism. 19 men, trained by Al-Qaeda, an Islamic terrorist organization led by Saudi millionaire Osama bin Laden, had conducted the attacks. Bush's rhetoric and that of the neoconservatives in his administration characterized the war on terror as an inevitable conflict that was part of a clash of civilizations, predicted by the political scientist Samuel P. Huntington in a 1993 article in Foreign Affairs. Once there had been wars between kings, then wars between peoples, then wars between ideologies, Huntington argued. But those ages had passed, and the future would be characterized by clashes between the world's great civilizations, first along the fault line between Western civilization and the Islamic world. Western dependence on Arab oil and the rise of Islamic fundamentalism had already led to the 1979 U.S. hostage crisis in Iran and the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, and in 1990 to the first Persian Gulf War. "America was targeted for attack because we're the brightest beacon for freedom and opportunity in the world," Bush said. Barack Obama, an Illinois state senator and constitutional law professor, offered a different interpretation in a Chicago newspaper. "The essence of this tragedy," he said, "derives from a fundamental absence of empathy on the part of the attackers, a deformation that grows out of a climate of poverty and ignorance, helplessness, and despair." It became something of a national myth later to describe the American people, long divided, as newly united after 9/11. More accurate would be to say that in those first days, politicians and writers who expressed views that strayed far from the mournful stoicism that characterized the response of both Bush on an international stage and Obama in a neighborhood newspaper were loudly denounced. These included Susan Sontag, who traced the origins of the attack to U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, the propping up of tyrants, the CIA toppling of Middle Eastern leaders, and the ongoing bombing of Iraq. "Where is the acknowledgement that this was not a cowardly attack on civilization or liberty or humanity or the free world, but an attack on the world's self-proclaimed superpower undertaken as a consequence of specific American alliances and actions?" Sontag asked in The New Yorker. In the matter of courage, a morally neutral virtue, whatever may be said of the perpetrators of Tuesday's slaughter, they were not cowards. In The Washington Post, Charles Krauthammer accused Sontag of moral obtuseness. From the right, Ann Coulter, a columnist who'd earlier worked for Paula Jones's legal team, wrote in the National Review, in an article posted online on September 13th, that drawing any distinctions between anyone in the Arab world was unnecessary, as was any investigation into the attacks. "This is no time to be precious about locating the exact individuals directly involved in this particular terrorist attack," Coulter wrote. "We don't need long investigations of the forensic evidence to determine with scientific accuracy the person or persons who ordered this specific attack. We should invade their countries, kill their leaders, and convert them to Christianity." 2 weeks later, the editor of the National Review announced that it regretted publishing Coulter's piece and stopped publishing her column. "I really believe the pagans and abortionists and the feminists and the gays and the lesbians who are actively trying to make that an alternative lifestyle, the ACLU, People for the American Way, all of them who've tried to secularize America, I point the finger in their face and say, you helped this happen," Jerry Falwell said immediately after the attacks. But he too was condemned, including by the president. Alex Jones, cluster bomb radio host, flew in under the radar of this opprobrium. On the afternoon of the attacks, he broadcast across the country, live from Austin, to nearly 100 affiliated stations for 5 hours. He began not with sympathy, not with grief, not with horror, but with gleeful self-congratulation. Well, I've been warning you about it for at least 5 years. All terrorism that we've looked at, from the World Trade Center at Oklahoma City to Waco, has been government actions. Jones crowed. They need this as a pretext to bring you and your family martial law. They're either using provocateur Arabs and allowing them to do it, as this is full complicity with the federal government. The evidence is overwhelming. Earlier that summer, Jones had issued a warning. Please! He'd screamed. Call Congress! Tell them we know the government is planning terrorism! On September 11th, he reported the morning's events, as if reading from an incidents log, adding details of his own. Dead bodies up to 6 blocks away, arms, legs, you name it! Interrupting with updates and cutting to eyewitnesses and coverage that sounded straight out of Orson Welles' The War of the Worlds. Like Welles, Jones asserted his own credibility by frequently sounding notes of caution. We don't know how many of these reports are accurate. While making singularly outrageous and vicious claims, even as surgeons in New York were amputating limbs and nurses were cleaning burned skin and firefighters falling down from exhaustion were digging through rubble, looking for survivors. I'll tell you the bottom line, Jones growled. 98% chance this was a government-orchestrated controlled bombing. Between 2001 and 2016, the demise of the daily newspaper following the spiraling decline of broadcast television contributed to a dizzying political disequilibrium, as if the world of news were suddenly revealed to be contained within a bouncy castle at an amusement park. New sources of news and opinion appeared like so many whirling, vertiginous rides, neon bright with screams of fright and delight, from blogs and digital newspapers to news aggregators and social media, roller coasters and water slides and teacup and saucer spinners. Facebook launched in 2004, YouTube in 2005, Twitter in 2006, the iPhone in 2007. By 2008, Twitter had 1 million users, and 1 in 6 Americans had a smartphone. 6 years later, those numbers had climbed teeteringly high. Twitter had 284 million users, and 2 out of 3 Americans owned smartphones. They clutched them in their hands as they rode and rolled, thrilled by the G-force drop and the eardrum popping rise and the sound of their own shrieking. New sources of news tended to be unedited, their facts unverified, their politics unhinged. Alternative political communities took the 1990s culture wars online, Tumblr on the left and 4chan on the right, trafficking in hysteria and irony, hatred and contempt. Tumblr performing the denunciation of white privilege with pious call-outs and demanding trigger warnings and safe spaces, 4chan pronouncing white supremacy and anti-feminism by way of ironic memes and murderous trolls. In a throwback to the political intrigues of the Cold War, Russia-sponsored hackers and trolls, posing as Americans, created fake Twitter and Facebook accounts whose purpose was to undermine the authority of the mainstream news, widen the American partisan divide, stoke racial and religious animosity, and incite civil strife. Under these circumstances, the fevered rants of deranged conspiracy theorists reached a new and newly receptive audience, but in a much broader and deeper sense, in an age of ceaseless online spectacle and massive corporate and government surveillance, nearly all political thinking became conspiratorial. Jones, in retrospect, was the least but also the worst of this. The amusement park's deadly but absurd Stephen King clown. After 9/11, he briefly lost some of his affiliates, but he didn't especially need a radio network. In 1999, he'd launched a website called InfoWars, where he presented himself to the world as a citizen journalist, a fighter for the truth by way of the new, no-holds-barred medium of the Internet. On September 11th, InfoWars warned the federal government, they are preparing to radically re-engineer our society forever. That day, Jones inaugurated what came to be called the Truther Movement, a faction of conspiracy theorists who believed that the United States government was behind the 9/11 attacks. The vice president, Jones would later elaborate, had been disappointed by the passenger revolt on United Flight 93. If it would have hit its target, Jones said, the government would have been completely decapitated and the president would have declared total martial law. Jones, wild with malice, cut through the American political imagination with a chainsaw rigged to a broom handle, flailing and gnashing. In 2008, when Barack Obama sought the Democratic nomination for president in a close competition with Hillary Clinton, Jones and other truthers became birthers. They argued that Obama, who was born in Hawaii, an event reported in 2 Hawaiian newspapers and recorded on his birth certificate, had been born in Kenya. The truthers were the far fringes, but even the broader American public raised an eyebrow at Obama's name, Barack Hussein Obama, at a time when the United States' declared enemies were Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein. Urged to change his name, Obama refused. Instead, he joked about it. "People call me Alabama," he'd say on the campaign trail. "They call me Yo Mama, and that's my supporters." So far from changing his name, Obama made his story his signature. His 2008 campaign for hope and change was lifted by soaring storytelling about the nation's long march to freedom and equality, in which he used his own life as an allegory for American history, in the tradition of Benjamin Franklin, Andrew Jackson, and Frederick Douglass. But Obama's story was new. "I am the son of a black man from Kenya and a white woman from Kansas," he said. "These people are part of me, and they are part of America." Obama's family was every color and part of a very big world. "I have brothers, sisters, nieces, nephews, uncles, and cousins of every race and every hue scattered across three continents, and for as long as I live, I will never forget that in no other country on earth is my story even possible." Obama's election as the United States' first black president was made possible by centuries of black struggle, by runaways and rebellions, by war and exile, by marches and court cases, by staggering sacrifices. "Barack Obama is what comes at the end of that bridge in Selma," said the much-admired man who had marched at Selma, John Lewis. His victory seemed to usher in a new era in American history, a casting off of the nation's agonizing legacy of racial violence, the realizing at long last of the promises made in the nation's founding documents. Yet as he took office in 2009, Obama inherited a democracy in disarray. The United States was engaged in two distant wars with little popular support and few achievable objectives, fought by a military drawn disproportionately from the poor, as if they were drones operated by richer men. The economy had collapsed in one of the worst stock market crashes in American history. The working class had seen no increase in wages for more than a generation. One in three black men between the ages of 20 and 29 was in prison or on probation. Both parties had grown hollow, hard and partisan on the outside, empty on the inside, while political debate, newly waged almost entirely online, had become frantic, desperate, and paranoid. Between 1958 and 2015, the proportion of Americans who told pollsters that they basically trust the government fell from 73% to 19%. 40 years of a relentless conservative attack on the government and the press had produced a public that trusted neither. 40 years of identity politics had shattered Rooseveltian liberalism. Obama walked on shards of glass. Even as Obama embraced a family of cousins scattered across continents, nationalism and even white supremacy were growing in both the United States and Europe, in the form of populist movements that called for immigration restriction, trade barriers, and in some cases, the abdication of international climate accords. New movements emerged from the right, the Tea Party in 2009, and the alt-right in 2010, and from the left, Occupy in 2011, Black Lives Matter in 2013. Activists on the left, including those aligned with an anti-fascist resistance known as Antifa, self-consciously cast their campaigns as international movements, but the new American populism and a resurgent white nationalism had their counterparts in other countries too. Whatever their political differences, they shared a political style. In a time of accelerating change, both the far left and the far right came to understand history itself as a plot, an understanding advanced by the very formlessness of the internet, anonymous and impatient. Online, the universe appeared to be nothing so much as an array of patterns in search of an explanation, provided to people unwilling to trust any authority but that of their own fevered, reckless, and thrill-seeking political imaginations. In 2001, during Obama's second term, the aging New York businessman, television star, and on-again-off-again presidential candidate Donald Trump aligned himself with the truthers and the birthers by questioning the president's citizenship. In a country where the Supreme Court had ruled in Dred Scott that no person born of African descent could ever be an American citizen, to say that Obama was not a citizen was to call upon centuries of racial hatred. Like 9/11 conspiracy theorists, Obama conspiracy theorists, who were in many cases the same people, were forever adding details to their story. The president was born in Nairobi. He was educated at a madrasa in Jakarta. He was secretly a Muslim. He was still more secretly an anti-imperialist African nationalist, like his father. He was on a mission to make America African. "The most powerful country in the world," right-wing pundit Dinesh D'Souza warned, is being governed by the dreams of a Luo tribesman of the 1950s. Trump, bypassing newspapers and television and broadcasting directly to his supporters, waged this campaign online through his Twitter account. An extremely credible source has called my office and told me that at Barack Obama's birth certificate is a fraud, he tweeted in 2012. Trump did not back off this claim as he pursued the Republican nomination in 2015. The backbone of his campaign was a promise to build a wall along the U.S.-Mexican border. After 9/11, a white nationalist movement that had foundered for decades had begun to revive in pursuit of two goals, preserving the icons of the Confederacy and ending the immigration of dark-skinned peoples. Trump, announcing his candidacy from New York's Trump Tower, gave a speech in which he called Mexicans trying to enter the United States rapists, borrowing from a book by Ann Coulter called Adios America. On immigration and much else, Coulter promoted herself as a courageous teller of truths in a world of lies. Every single elite group in America is aligned against the public. The media, ethnic activists, big campaign donors, Wall Street, multimillionaire farmers, and liberal churches, Coulter wrote. The media lie about everything, but immigration constitutes their finest hour of collective lying. Obama had promised hope and change. Trump promised to make America great again. Hillary Clinton, having lost the Democratic nomination to Obama in 2008, won it in 2016 and hoped to become the first female president. Her campaign misjudged Trump and not only failed to address the suffering of blue-collar voters, but also insulted Trump supporters, dismissing half of them as a basket of deplorables. Mitt Romney had done much the same thing as the Republican nominee in 2012, when, with seething contempt, he dismissed the 47% of the U.S. population, Obama's supporters, as people who believe they are victims. Party politics had so far abandoned any sense of a national purpose that within the space of 4 years, each of the party's presidential nominees declared large portions of the population of the United States unworthy of their attention and beneath their contempt. Trump, having secured the nomination, campaigned against Clinton, aided by the UK data firm Cambridge Analytica, by arguing that she belonged in jail. She is an abject, psychopathic demon from hell that as soon as she gets into power is going to try to destroy the planet, said Jones, who sold Hillary for prison T-shirts. Lock her up, Trump supporters said at his rallies. American history became, in these years, a wound that bled and bled again. Gains made toward realizing the promise of the Constitution were lost. Time seemed to be moving both backward and forward. Americans fought over matters of justice, rights, freedom, and America's place in the world with a bitter viciousness, and not only online. Each of the truths on which the nation was founded and for which so many people had fought was questioned. The idea of truth itself was challenged. The only agreed-upon truth appeared to be a belief in the ubiquity of deception. The 2008 Obama campaign assembled a truth team. You lie, a South Carolina congressman called out to President Obama during a joint session of Congress in 2011. You are fake news, Trump said to a CNN reporter at an event at the White House. Let facts be submitted to a candid world, Jefferson had written in the Declaration of Independence, founding a nation by appealing to truth. But whatever had been left of a politics of reasoned debate, of inquiry and curiosity, of evidence and fair-mindedness, seemed to have been eradicated when, on December 2, 2015, Trump appeared on InfoWars, by Skype, from Trump Tower. In an earlier campaign rally, Trump had said that on 9/11 he'd been watching television from his penthouse and had seen footage of thousands and thousands of people, Muslims, cheering from rooftops in New Jersey. Jones began by congratulating Trump on being vindicated on this point. Trump had not, in fact, been vindicated, and no such footage has ever been found. Jones, sputtering, gushed about the historic nature of Trump's campaign. What you're doing is epic, Jones told Trump. It's George Washington level. Your reputation is amazing, Trump told Jones, promising, I will not let you down. 5 days later, Trump called for a total and complete shutdown of the entry of Muslims to the United States. In place of towers, there would be walls. Between the attacks on September 11, 2001, and the election of Donald Trump 15 years later on November 9, 2016, the United States lost its way in a cloud of smoke. The party system crashed, the press crumbled, and all three branches of government imploded. There was real fear that the American political process was being run by Russians, as if somehow the Soviets had won the Cold War after all. To observers who included the authors of books like How Democracy Ends, Why Liberalism Failed, How the Right Lost Its Mind, and How Democracies Die, it seemed, as Trump took office, as if the nation might break out in a civil war, as if the American experiment had failed, as if democracy itself were in danger of dying. 1. It began in the year 1999 with a panic. Computer programmers predicted that at 1 second after midnight on January 1, 2000, all of the world's computers, unable to accommodate a year that did not begin with 1-9, would crash. Even before the 21st century began, even before no small number of political dystopians forecast the thousand-year clash of civilizations or the imminent death of democracy, Americans were subjected to breathless warnings of millennial doom, a ticking clock catastrophe. Not the global annihilation timed by the atomic age's doomsday clock, but a disaster, a Y2K bug, embedded into the programs written to run on the microprocessor talked into the motherboard. A Y2K bug embedded into the programs written to run on the microprocessor tucked into the motherboard of the hulking computer perched on every desktop. After much rending of garments and gnashing of teeth, this bug was quietly and entirely fixed. The end of the world averted, digital prophets next undertook to predict the exact date of the arrival of an Aquarian age of peace, unity, and harmony, ushered in by, of all things, the Internet. In the spring of 2000, Wired, the slick punk day-glow magazine of the dot-com era, announced that the Internet had, in fact, already healed a divided America. We are, as a nation, better educated, more tolerant, and more connected because of, not in spite of, the convergence of the Internet and public life. Partisanship, religion, geography, race, gender, and other traditional political divisions are giving way to a new standard, wiredness, as an organizing principle for political and social attitudes. Of all the wide-eyed technological boosterism in American history, from the telegraph to the radio, few pronouncements rose to such dizzying rhetorical heights. Over the course of the 20th century, the United States had assumed an unrivaled position in the world as the defender of liberal states, democratic values, and the rule of law. From NATO to NAFTA, relations between states had been regulated by pacts, free trade agreements, and restraint. But beginning in 2001 with the War on Terror, the United States undermined and even abdicated the very rules it had helped to establish, including prohibitions on torture and wars of aggression. By 2016, a by-any-means-necessary disregard for restraints on conduct had come to characterize American domestic politics as well. "If you see somebody getting ready to throw a tomato," Trump told supporters at a campaign rally in Iowa, "knock the crap out of them, would you?" Countless factors contributed to these changes. But the crisis of American moral authority that began with the War on Terror at the start of the 21st century cannot be understood outside the rise of the Internet, which is everything a rule-based order is not, lawless, unregulated, and unaccountable. What became the Internet had begun in the late 1960s with ARPANET. By the mid-1970s, the Department of Defense's Advanced Research Project Agencies Network had grown to an international network of networks, an Internet for short. In 1989 in Geneva, Tim Berners-Lee, an English computer scientist, proposed a protocol to link pages on what he called the World Wide Web. The first web page in the United States was created in 1991 at Stanford. Berners-Lee's elegant protocol spread fast, first across universities and then to the public. The first widely available web browser, Mosaic, was launched in 1993, making it possible for anyone with a personal computer wired to the Internet to navigate web pages around the world, click by astonishing click. Wired, launched in March 1993, flaunted cyberculture's countercultural origins. Its early contributors included Stuart Brand and John Perry Barlow, a gold necklace and scarf-wearing bearded mystic who for many years wrote lyrics for the Grateful Dead. In Wired, the counterculture's dream of a non-hierarchical, non-organizational world of harmony found expression in a new digital utopianism, as if every Internet cable were a string of love beads. Brand, writing in an article in Time, "We Owe It All to the Hippies," announced that the real legacy of the 60s generation is the computer revolution. But between the 1960s and the 1990s, the revolution had moved from the far left to the far right. Wired was edited by Louis Rossetto, a libertarian and former anarchist known to lament the influence of the mainstream media. In the magazine's inaugural issue, Rossetto predicted that the Internet would bring about social changes so profound their only parallel is probably the discovery of fire. The The internet would create a new world order. Except it wouldn't be an order. It would be an open market, free of all government interference, a frontier, a wild west. In 1990, Barlow had helped found the Electronic Frontier Foundation to promote this vision. The EFF later became chiefly concerned with matters of intellectual property, free speech, and privacy. In 1993, Wired announced that life in cyberspace seems to be shaping up exactly like Thomas Jefferson would have wanted, founded on the primacy of individual liberty and a commitment to pluralism, diversity, and community. The Digital Utopians think tank was Newt Gingrich's Progress and Freedom Foundation, established in 1993 and later the subject of an ethics inquiry. Its key thinker was an irrepressible George Gilder, resurrected. Gingrich appeared on the cover of Wired in 1995, Gilder in 1996. Gingrich was battling in Congress for a new Telecommunications Act, the first major revision of the FCC founding 1934 Federal Communications Act, itself a revision of the 1927 Federal Radio Act. His objective was to ensure that, unlike radio or television, the new medium would lie beyond the realm of government regulation. At a 1994 meeting of Gingrich's Progress and Freedom Foundation in Aspen, Gilder, along with futurists Alvin Toffler and Esther Dyson, and the physicist George Keyworth, Reagan's former science advisor, drafted a Magna Carta for the Information Age. It established the framework of the act Gingrich hoped to pass, announcing that cyberspace is the latest American frontier. The writers of the new Magna Carta contended that while the industrial age might have required government regulation, the knowledge age did not. "If there is to be an industrial policy for the knowledge age," their Magna Carta proclaimed, "it should focus on removing barriers to competition and massively deregulating the fast-growing telecommunications and computing industries." Gingrich got his wish. On February 8, 1996, in an event broadcast live and over the Internet, Bill Clinton signed the Telecommunications Act in the reading room of the Library of Congress. He signed on paper, and he also signed online at a computer terminal. If little noticed at the time, Clinton's approval of this startling piece of legislation would prove a lasting and terrible legacy of his presidency. It deregulated the communications industry, lifting virtually all of its New Deal anti-monopoly provisions, allowing for the subsequent consolidation of media companies, and prohibiting regulation of the Internet, with catastrophic consequences. Nevertheless, that the U.S. government would even presume to legislate the Internet, even if only to promise not to regulate it, alarmed the Internet libertarians. On the day Clinton signed the bill, Barlow, ex-hippie, become the darling of world bankers and billionaires, watching from the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, wrote a Declaration of Independence of Cyberspace. "Governments of the industrial world, you weary giants of flesh and steel, I come from cyberspace, the new home of mind. On behalf of the future, I ask you of the past to leave us alone. You are not welcome among us. You have no sovereignty where we gather. Governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed. You have neither solicited nor received ours. We did not invite you. You do not know us, nor do you know our world. Cyberspace does not lie within your borders." He posted this statement on the web, where it became one of the very first posts to spread, as was said, like a virus, an infection. Cyber-utopians who had no use for government ignored the altogether inconvenient fact that, of course, not only the Internet itself, but also nearly all the tools used to navigate it, along with the elemental inventions of the digital age, had been built or subsidized by taxpayer-funded, government-sponsored research. The iPhone, taking only one example, depended on the unquestionable and extraordinary ingenuity of Apple, but it also depended on U.S. government-funded research that had early resulted in several key technological developments, including GPS, multi-touch screens, LCD displays, lithium-ion batteries, and cellular networks. Nevertheless, Barlow and his followers believed that the Internet existed entirely outside government, as if it had sprung up mirabile dictu out of nowhere, before and outside of civil society and the rule of law, in the borderless psychedelic fantasy world of cyberspace. "I ask you of the past to leave us alone," Barlow pleaded. But if the futurists were uninterested in the past, they seemed also strangely incautious about the future. With rare exception, early Internet boosters who fought for deregulation and antitrust measures, even as they benefited from the munificence of the federal government, evidenced little concern about the possible consequences of those measures on income inequality and political division in the United States and around the world. The Internet, a bottomless sea of information and ideas, had profound effects on the diffusion of knowledge, and especially on its speed and reach, both of which were accelerated by smartphones. If not so significant to human history as the taming of fire, it was at least as significant as the invention of the printing press. It accelerated scholarship, science, medicine, and education. It aided commerce and business. But in its first two decades, its unintended economic and political consequences were often dire. Stability in American politics had depended not on the wealth of the few, but on the comfort of the many, not on affluence, but on security and a commitment to the notion of the commonwealth. The Internet did not destroy the American middle class, but it did play a role in its decline. It fueled economic growth and generated vast fortunes for a tiny clutch of people at a time when the poor were becoming poorer and the middle class disappearing. It turned out that the anti-monopoly regulations of the industrial era, far from being obsolete, were sorely needed in the information age. And the vaunted promise of internet connection, the gauzy fantasy of libertarians and anarchists who imagined a world without government, produced nothing so much as a world disconnected and distraught. Silicon Valley, as it grew, earned a reputation as a liberal enclave, but it also drew a younger generation of libertarians, who had come not from the counterculture, but from the new right. Peter Thiel, born in Germany in 1967, had gone to Stanford and then on to Stanford Law School, where in 1987 he had founded the Stanford Review with funding from Irving Kristol. It aimed to counter campus multiculturalism, feminism, and political correctness, whose rise at Stanford Thiel had lamented in the diversity myth, a 1990s update and dilution of God and man at Yale. George Gilder and Robert Bork were among Thiel's heroes. Bork's writings on the error of antitrust laws informed much Silicon Valley libertarianism. After a brief career as a lawyer and a stock trader, Thiel had returned to California in 1996, just in time for the dot-com boom, which followed the lifting of restrictions on commercial traffic on the Internet. 10,000 websites were launched every day, poppies in a field. In 1996, Bob Dole, an unlikely but bold pioneer, became the first presidential candidate to have a website. Amazon was founded in 1994, Yahoo in 1995, Google in 1998. In 1998, Thiel co-founded PayPal, hoping that it would free the citizens of the world from government-managed currency. PayPal will give citizens worldwide a more direct control over their currencies than they ever had before, he promised. The Silicon Valley entrepreneur, almost always a man, became the unrivaled hero of the second Gilded Age. He was a rescued man, the male breadwinner defended by George Gilder in the 1970s against the forces of feminism, saved, and newly seen as saving the nation itself. Multi-billion-dollar internet deals were made every day. In 4 years, the value of dot-coms, many of which had not earned a profit, rose by as much as 3,000%. By 1999, Bill Gates, at 43, had become the richest man in the world, and Microsoft, the first corporation in history, valued at more than $500 billion. Inventors from Benjamin Franklin to Thomas Edison had been called men of progress. Silicon Valley had disruptive innovators. The language was laden, freighted with the weight of centuries. Historically, the idea of innovation has been opposed to the idea of progress. From the Reformation through the Enlightenment, progress, even in its secular usage, connoted moral improvement, a journey from sin to salvation, from error to truth. Innovation, on the other hand, meant imprudent and rash change. 18th-century conservatives had called Jacobinism an innovation in politics. Edmund Burke had derided the French Revolution as a revolt of innovation, and Federalists opposing Jefferson had declared themselves to be enemies of innovation. Over the 19th century, the meaning of progress narrowed, coming more often to mean merely technological improvement. In the 20th century, innovation began to replace progress when used in this sense, but it also meant something different and more strictly commercial. In 1939, the economist Joseph Schumpeter, in a landmark study of business cycles, used innovation to mean bringing new products to market, a usage that spread only slowly and only in the specialized scholarly literatures of economics and business. In 1942, Schumpeter theorized about creative destruction, language that after Hiroshima had virtually no appeal. Progress, too, accreted critics. In the age of the atom bomb, the idea of progress seemed to many people obscene. Salvation had not, in fact, been found in machines. To the contrary. Innovation gradually emerged as an all-purpose replacement. Progress without goodness. Innovation might make the world a better place, or it might not. The point was, innovation was not concerned with goodness. It was concerned with novelty, speed, and profit. Disruption entered the argot in the 1990s. To disrupt something is to take it apart. The chief proselytizer of disruptive innovation, a rebranding of creative destruction, was Clayton M. Christensen, a professor at Harvard Business School. In 1997, Christensen published The Innovator's Dilemma, a business Bible for entrepreneurs, in which he argued that companies that make only sustaining innovations, careful, small, gradual refinements, are often